Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
Regardless of what the public was going to think or what anybody was going to think, I knew inside, the same way that I knew when I was, you know, 21 to drop out of college and go home and start a band. It was the same feeling of like, I have to step out of this box and create something different and see where it takes me.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
Okay, so, Lowell, we're going to go straight to our guest this evening. We want to give a big welcome to Bethany Cosentino. Bethany, how you doing?
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
I'm going to get out with the first question because I've lived in LA a long time, like 30 years, and it seems to me most people come to Los Angeles either, you know, with the hope of being discovered, or they come here and they get something goes wrong and things go bad and they get destroyed, or it's both. They get discovered and destroyed, right? But my experience was kind of different because I had been here beforehand, you know, with The Cure and stuff a lot of times, and I was married to a Californian, and then we were out here half the year and back in England half the year, and so I knew the place fairly well. But when I came to live here eventually, because, you know, I got divorced and everything, and I came to live here, I found a lot of love. So I wonder what your experience with Los Angeles has been.
Well, I was born and raised here, actually. I'm one of the few. I feel like I meet more and more people as I get older who are not from here, who kind of moved here similar to what you're saying with dreams, aspirations.
Yeah.
My parents actually are the ones that moved here with the dreams and the aspirations. My father is a musician. And so my dad moved out here to kind of, you know, follow his dream and go to Hollywood and, you know, play the Sunset Strip and do all the things. But I love it here. And I feel like it's such a part of my DNA. I can't imagine myself going anywhere else. I tried living in New York for a while. Yeah. And
how was that?
It was just too... You know, I love New York as a place. I really do. But it is not a place where I feel that I can live. I love being in my car. I love to drive. I love to sit in my car. I love to like do emails in my car in a parking lot. I like going through the drive-thru Starbucks. Like, I am just a regular old...
Breakfast in the car.
Yeah. Like, I feel that my car is like my mobile office. And like, when I was living in New York, I was also, you know, like 20, but I just didn't feel like I could escape the world in the same way that you can in Los Angeles. Like in LA, there are different areas where you can go, right, to get out of the city and get out of the hustle and bustle. So I, for one, love it.
Yeah, no, I've heard that from, like my wife has lived here ever since. She was born in the Philippines, but she moved here when she was a year old. So she's been here her whole life, essentially.
Yeah.
And she has the same viewpoint. You know, she likes to travel. She likes to go and look at lots of places. But at the end of the day, this is where we're going to live. And I'm fine with that. At first, you know, years ago before I lived here, I didn't think I would be. Mm-hmm. But I've grown to really love and appreciate the place.
Well, I was so convinced I was going to have to live in LA. You know, that was the only place left open for me. When the band split and Susie and I split, I even wrote it, I think I even put it in the divorce papers, you know, I'm going to be in LA. And I think that made me look like I was really flush. And knew exactly what I was doing. Yeah. And so I kind of like, well, he's going to LA. So he must have, obviously he's okay. So we don't need to give him anything. And at least said about that properly, the better. But no, I got on a plane. I think I may have used somebody else's air miles to get there. Sorry. and I had more friends in LA, older friends. In fact, lol, I don't even recall, we didn't get in touch at that point.
No, not immediately. But I mean, it was like, yeah, I mean, it's been a place where, I don't know, it's like the clearinghouse for all British musicians at some point, you know. It's true, we all come here at some point.
The Banshees, like Steve, Severin and Susie both knew Billy Idol because Steve went to school with him, you know. So we'd always meet Billy. He'd always come like backstage somewhere. And, you know, he was just larger than life and show us all the underside of LA, you know, the bad bars and...
Yeah.
And then, of course, Joseph and at that point it was Joseph and Henry who started off Vinyl Fetish in New York, I think. Around maybe, oh no, it was in LA. It's definitely in LA. It was Bleaker Bob's in New York. And then so they were like DJing and running some of the best clubs, Cherry, Sex or something or other. I can't remember. Cinematic, these clubs around LA.
Right.
But I loved it coming over because eventually I learned to drive because I didn't learn to drive a car until I was like 30, I think. And the reason was so I could rent a car when I got to somewhere like LA,
yeah.
Which meant that I could leave the entourage and go over into the valley somewhere or just get lost on a freeway. Because I did. You just get lost. And it amazed me that you could drive from West Hollywood to Santa Monica and still be in LA, but totally different cities.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, I think that's part of why I like it, kind of what I was saying, where it's like, you can live in LA without feeling like you're so surrounded by the industry or feeling like you're surrounded by, you know, Hollywood or the ocean. Like you can go to all of those places, but you can also sort of like pick what your vibe is at any given moment and just kind of go there. And I've had periods with LA where I'm like, do I want to leave? Do I want to stay here for the rest of my life? But it kind of just feels like a place, like I said, it just intrinsically feels like it's a part of me as a person. And maybe someday I'll end up somewhere else and look back and be like, I can't believe I thought I was going to be in LA forever. But I'm really comfortable here. And I feel like it is a really, you know, welcoming place and a place where you can just be yourself. And, you know, there's a million freaks on the streets of LA. No one, you know, you can be whoever you want.
I feel also, you know, having lived here for a long time now, I realize that, you know, if the city gets to feel too much at any point, which is hard because it's not like New York where everything is right on top of you all the time.
Yeah.
If the city gets to, you know, it's easy. You just drive out to the desert for 2 hours. You know, you're out there in a couple of hours and it's like empty, you know? So I think I'm going to get a little bolt hole out there, I've decided. I like it going out, you know, because it's something I've never experienced, the desert. So yeah, no, I agree with you. I can't see myself living anywhere else, you know, and I've lived different places. I lived in London, I lived in Paris, and I lived in the middle of the countryside as well with nobody for miles. But in the end, I kind of like the fact that there's, like you said, there's everything for everybody here.
Yeah. And I find too, like, as you said, you can go out to the desert. There's like, in terms of nature and geographical locations, it's like, we have everything. We have the ocean, we have mountains, we have the desert, we have, you know, forests. You can travel up into the mountains and go to, you know, Big Bear and be surrounded, or like up north, you can go and be in redwood forests, you know? So I like that. And as I get older, my relationship to nature becomes, I'm kind of like a corny, like tree hugging hippie now, where I'm just like, I want to be in nature.
It's kind of natural, but I mean, the other natural thing is, and here's the question is, so when you went to New York, that was, I presume, sort of like that kind of time in your life, earlier in your life, that you sort of went and decided you're going to find something different?
Yeah. So I think I was like 21 when I moved to New York, but I, being sort of like raised around music, music has always been like a massive part of my life, and was kind of always like in the stars that I was going to become, you know, a musician in some capacity. But around that age, I was like, I don't think I want to do music. I want to go to school to be a creative writer. Like, I was like, oh, I'll just, like, you know, go to school for creative writing. And it's like, what do you do with a creative writing degree? Right. But so I dropped out of high school, actually, because I was, you know, like a young punk chasing dreams of, you know, oh, I'm just, fuck it, I don't need high school. And then I decided to go get my GED, and then I went to community college. And then I had, again, this dream of moving to New York and being a writer. So I busted my ass to get into a really prestigious, like, liberal arts school there. I went, I tried it out. I did a semester and a half, and I said, no, I am not built for school. I just want to play music. And so I dropped out. I hauled ass across the country. I came back. And I just started my band Best Coast. And so I think at the time it was like, I was young and I was trying, I was like, I want to do things differently than I always have. So there was this fantasy element to it,
right?
Especially again, of the fantasy of like, I'm going to go to New York and be a writer. Like,
yeah.
that's a very like unique thought, right? Everybody wants that. And so when I got there, I think I just realized like, wait, I think I'm actually happy with what I have back in LA, and maybe I can try to, you know, actually do something with music and see where it takes me. And it led me directly down a road of a professional career in music, which is not something I like was anticipating or expecting, but, you know, I followed my intuition and things worked out. I think music is one of those things where it's like, if it's going to be your job and it's going to be your career, you obviously need to have a passion to do it. But I don't know, maybe this is just me being, you know, a born and raised LA girl, but I feel like it chooses you in a way. It's like, you can try to run away from it, but I feel like it just kind of catches up with you if it's something that you're supposed to be doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Me and Budgie have been trying to run away for it for quite a while now. He's grabbing us and pulling us back.
Find you in everywhere. When you got back to Los Angeles, Bethany, so did you meet the people that became Best Coast straight away, or was it a long process?
No, so my collaborator in Best Coast, his name is Bob Bruno, and I knew him from just growing up going to like punk shows, house shows, DIY, like I knew him from sort of the music scene around LA. And he was much older than me, but he was like a guy that sort of all of my friends who had bands at the time, like we all went to Bob to be like, can you help record us? Can you help us set up pedal boards? Can you like take our guitars to get set up? He was just like the dude around town that everybody was connected to in one way or another. So when I decided to move back and start a project, I was like, okay, well, I know how to write songs. I know how to play enough guitar that I can figure this thing out, but I don't know the first thing about any gear. I don't know any, like, my brain just doesn't work that way. I'm like the real creative person who's like, I just figure out a way to make it happen, but I need help.
Yeah.
And so I just went to Bob and was like, would you want to do this with me? And he just, you know, was just like, yeah, sounds good. Sounds chill. Like, just start sending me songs. So I just started writing these like very bare-boned demos, just drenched in distortion and reverb in GarageBand, didn't know what the fuck I was doing, just like, you know, hit some buttons and was like, okay, I think this is right. And then it just went from there, and it was just, you know, he and I for a long time until we sort of figured out like, oh, this is a thing. So I think we have to build this to like catch up with the thing that it's become.
And how long was the thing? How long was this period?
I started writing music for Best Coast in 2009. And the debut Best Coast album came out in 2010, and it happened relatively quickly. Like it started with just singles and 7-inches, and sort of coming from a punk DIY background, I knew all these people that were like, yeah, we can release a single, we can get a 7-inch press for you, we can put out a tape, whatever. And so I just started there. And then this was also like back when MySpace was a place that you could still share music, and you know, and so I just sort of gathered some buzz and some fans across the internet. And then between that time and when the record came out, it didn't stop. Like it just kept kind of going and going and going until Bob and I sort of looked at each other and were kind of like, oh, this is a thing. Like I remember in the beginning, he asked me when we first started recording just on a 4-track at his house, like he asked me, do you want to play shows? Like, do you see that being a thing? And I literally just was like, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I guess we could try that. Yeah, sure. Sounds good. Yeah. And, you know, 15 years later, I have a full career and, you know, I'm segueing into doing a different album and like all of these things. It's just like, it's wild what happens if you just follow your gut, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one thing I always said to my son growing up. I said, I don't really care what you decide to do, but do something that you enjoy, because then you'll probably be good at it.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
And that's really the truth of the thing. I was thinking about the name. I mean, did you name the band? Did you think, okay, we call it the Best Coast because the West Coast is the best coast? And is it like a sort of flag to wave at people, or do you just think it sounded good? You know, I mean,
it was kind of a multitude of different things. One was BC are my initials, Bethany Cosentino. And also when you say Best Coast, it kind of sounds like my name, like Bethany Cosentino. And then also, yeah, it was like a band that was heavily influenced at the beginning by, you know, the California sound. I was just enamored by the Beach Boys, and I wanted to create a Phil Spector reverb heavy sunshine lo-fi palm trees blowing in the wind sound.
Okay.
And so it made sense to be like Best Coast, you know? And when I told Bob that I was like, I think I want to call it Best Coast, he was like, I literally thought the same thing. So it felt like, you know, a kismet. Okay, well, this is what it has to be.
Living here for a while, driving around places, like you drive around Laurel Canyon and stuff, and you see places and people say, oh, that's where Mama Cash used to live and
stuff,
you know. So it's very real in a very visceral sense, you know, more so than any other American city. I mean, you know, I've been to New York was the first place I ever came when I was 21, and I just thought, well, it was kind of overwhelming, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know where anything was, and I didn't know, you know, my way around at all. So I just walked down the streets in very bad neighborhoods without, you know, I didn't have any fear of it because I didn't know what the hell, you know, where I was. So,
yeah.
But I never really sort of came across things like I do here where people say, oh, yeah, so and so used to live there, or, you know, this happened there. It seems much more immediate to me here, you know?
Yeah. And then you think too about how much, I mean, obviously there's a lot of history and music in New York as well, but you think about Los Angeles and just sort of, you know, it's the studios and all of these things. And like, I've worked at Sunset Sound before, and you're in Sunset Sound and you're like, you know, the Doors were in this room recording.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, I'm just sitting in the same space that Jim Morrison sat in at one point. And it's like, there's ghosts all over this city of just incredible creative legacies. And I do agree with you where it's like New York is just its own thing. And I feel like it is a wonderful, incredible thing with clearly so much history and so many stories. But Los Angeles just feels like also there's like the lure of stardom, right? It's like, that's what people come here for.
The stars on the boulevard.
Yeah, you go down Hollywood Boulevard and it's like people seeing just like these images of fame and these images of like what everybody thinks is like the key to success and the key to like happiness. It's just like your star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. But then also something that I was always inspired by with LA as well was how there is a dark underbelly to this city as well. There is like, there's a lot of, I mean, you think about too, in that same era of this golden kind of California sound, there was also the Manson murders and these horrible, tragic things that were happening at the same time. And I do think that like Los Angeles has a lot of dualities in terms of sunshine and then also darkness. And it's interesting to sort of look at those two things and how they work together.
I always thought it was interesting. We came first came over and I think we kind of landed probably more or less straight into Los Angeles and the whiskey and things. Mm-hmm. And I wanted a pair of like, you know, black engineer's boots, you know, this kind of motorcycle, like real heavy things that bled on everything that you wore with them. But it was like, that was what was strange about LA was you mismade a decision how you were going to dress because, you know, if you dressed for the weather, you would never wear motorcycle boots or black leather or a big coat, you know, because it's just too hot. Unless you came out at night and it was like there'd have been a light rain or something.
Yeah.
So it was a bit contradictory. But we kind of certainly, I felt drawn to the darker side of it. And also it seemed like if you wanted to get on and do something, it was easier maybe just to find the right feeling. In New York, it was kind of hidden. People sort of, it was kind of hidden away. You were not, it was a bit like London. It was really hard to find where to go and how to break in.
Yeah, exactly.
In LA, I think it's kind of a bit more there, present.
Well, it's you know, the whole thing, you know, the theory, because it's, you know, generally, I mean, it hasn't been so much this year, but generally it's very pleasant weather most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, it makes people a bit more pleasant, or it makes them psychotic. So that's the, you know, that's the dark and the light. You know?
Well, this year has been really wild. I mean, I was like, is the sun ever going to come out again? And, you know, you've been here for 30 years, so it's like, you know that June gloom is a thing and May gray is a thing, and that's something that we're used to. But this year in particular, it was just like, this is never ending. This literally feels like it's never going to go away.
Right. It was overwhelming because, you know, I live close to the beach. So, you know, the marine layer anyway comes in all the time. And it's like, this year, I think I've seen about maybe three really sunny days, and that's ridiculous. We're nearly in July, you know?
It's wild.
Oh, we got lots here. We're having a heat wave every day in Berlin, really.
I know, and that's the thing. I have all these friends that were going to like Europe for the summer, and we're like in London, and they're like, oh my God, the sun is just shining, and I'm in shorts and a tank top. And meanwhile, like we're in LA, and I'm wearing like a literal jacket in July. And I'm like, what is happening?
A jacket in July. Write that one down. That's a jacket in July.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. That's the title for your new album, Jacket in July.
So I moved here to Berlin in 2009. So that's when you started writing songs for like Best Coast. But when did you get this kind of, I take it you're all still like friends, or maybe, I don't know what's gone on. But so now you're kind of, I read something where it said you was really finding your identity or something, because both Lol and I really understand the loss of identity that comes when you're in a band for a while.
Yeah.
You know, well, you just become the band. You become more than the band. You become nothing in a way. You disappear. Was that an experience you had?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, also when Best Coast started, I was young. I was 22. And I didn't have boundaries, let's just say. And so I didn't know that I could like, you know, make music and sort of be a personality without sharing every thought that came into my head, every single thing, and letting every single person on the internet in, you know? And I think that because I am a very open and honest sort of person, I think my fans connect to that. But at the same time, it also allowed for a lot of external noise. And I was very impressionable. I was also somebody who I think who was searching for my identity, like externally, not within myself. And so I clung to these sort of narratives and personas that were being created for me. And as I grew older and as the band evolved and the sound evolved and I started to sort of drift away from the Beach Boys being my number one idol and kind of going more towards, well, maybe I want to make a different kind of record. Maybe I want to sound more like, you know, the Sundays or whatever.
Right.
It just felt like people kept bringing it back to the thing of like, no, it was already decided for you. You're this person and you fit in this box. And so I think that, you know, I both got pigeonholed, but also pigeonholed myself in a way. And I think that it was very important for me to get out of my comfort zone and sort of reclaim my identity as just Bethany and just go out and be myself. And as I mentioned, Bob, I've known Bob since I was 17, and he is like a big brother to me and is just the sweetest, most supportive guy. And I'm very grateful for that, because there are definitely a lot of people that would be like, what do you mean you're going solo? What do you mean you're leaving this behind? Like, you know, and could be egotistical about it and a bit of a non-supportive person, right? But instead, I was met with so much, like, he championed me and was like, yeah, go. If you need to go explore a different side of yourself, I'm not going to be mad at you for doing that. And so I do feel like it was really important for me, regardless of what the public was going to think or what anybody was going to think. I knew inside, the same way that I knew when I was, you know, 21 to drop out of college and go home and start a band. It was the same feeling of like, I have to step out of this box and create something different and see where it takes me.
Was that scary, or was it liberating, or was it a bit of both?
It was definitely a bit of both. And, you know, as I'm leading up, because the record comes out in a month, and as I'm like leading up to it, I'm kind of grappling with, there are some days that I'm like, this is the most liberating, freeing thing in the world. And then there are other days that I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? Why am I doing this? This is insane. And it's just a real roller coaster and a journey. And I'm just sort of like strapping in, and I'm just like, all right, here we go. I'm just going to follow this and see what happens. But I think if I remove all of the external stuff and I remove the numbers and streams and likes and all that bullshit, in my core, I feel wildly liberated and feel very, very excited.
You've touched on a thing there twice. Like, the internet was very much a part, and social media is very much a part of you when you started off.
Yes.
And from, of course, it became something, you know, with Lol and I suppose, post MTV, and that was a new thing. And social media as kind of something we've caught up with in a way. So you could see it as a massive advantage when you're starting off, but then I could also see the other side of that sword.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like having your website, and you have the forum, and you have people coming in there and talking, and they're like telling you what you should be doing next. And like, hey, we really didn't like that last tour. It was like, you know, the venues were really...
Oh my God. Yeah, people just don't, people have no shame in that sense. Mm-hmm. We need to bring back shame in that realm of the world, you know, where it's just like, people are just genuinely out here saying the first thing that comes to their mind, leaving a comment. And I always find that I try really hard now not to engage in any of that stuff, because it's not good for my mental health. But if I ever engage in it and say, like, if someone's like, this song sucks or whatever, and you just go like, LOL, cool, thanks for your opinion, I didn't ask, they will always write back and say, oh my God, I'm such a big fan. I'm so excited for the next chapter. And it's like, so you just wanted me to acknowledge you? Like, what's the deal here? You know?
Yeah.
And I think people forget that behind these platforms, there is a real person who is putting themselves out there. And I, you know, you can both attest to this, like, putting yourself out there is scary, and to, especially when it comes to things that are creative and art and things that you feel very tethered to in a personal way, like, it's really scary to put yourself out there.
every now and then I come across a letter or a kind of something that was addressed, usually addressed to Susie. Sometimes I got them as well. You know, this is like, these are those kind of 18-page kind of, you know, stuffed envelope. They were envelopes. They'd been handwritten, full of like drawings. And you realize this is the outpouring of somebody, you know, who's like besotted. And then you multiply that by however many outlets you have on social media. And we get like, you know, you go on tour and you get a few crazy letters and then you kind of put them in a box and maybe you'd write back or maybe somebody would write back for you or you just leave them. It's just, it's off the scale. So
My old rule of thumb used to be any letter that was longer than one or two pages is from somebody who's a little psychotic, so best not to read it, you know.
And you can sniff the envelope, lol, just like, you know, that was this, the sniff test, you know.
The smell can tell you.
Was it perfume or?
Yeah, right now with the, you know, the advent of social media and that, you know, most people, I would say 99.9% of people on the internet write things to me that are nice and you know, fine and interesting.
That's good. They love you, lol. They do.
Yeah. Most of the time, that's true. Occasionally, you get somebody through who's like, you know, I don't know, in some basement somewhere and thinks, you know, I can poke him. And they poke me. And I used to sort of get upset by that. And then eventually I'm like, yeah, they don't know me. They wouldn't say it to my face. So then I just ignore any of those things. You know, I don't even bother blocking them. I'm just ignore them because
absolutely,
you know, it sort of fades off into the background. It's like extra noise. And that's the same if you think, you know, you play a gig, you know, most of the people out there are clapping or whatever, and there's always some bloke at the back going, boo, boo.
I think some people just get off on being a contrarian. Like, they just do it to do it for shock value or whatever it is. And it's like, when you buy into it and you give people the satisfaction that they're clearly searching for by just fucking with you, then you let them win. It's like, if you just, if you try really hard to just let it go, I find that it, typically the people end up going away. But when I was really young and this was all starting, like it was the first time that I was experiencing any sort of fandom or success or anything. And so I was like, this is so exciting. I want to see what people are saying. And I very quickly learned that is a place to go if you are looking to feel bad. Mm. Because as you're saying, it's like most of the comments are like, I'm such a big fan. Thank you so much for the art. And it's just, depending on where you're at in your life, you know, particularly for me at that age, I was struggling with, you know, I was just struggling because I was so new to all of it. But it would just be one comment. That was all it would take, was one comment to just throw me off and just sulk through the rest of the day.
We're sensitive people.
Yeah.
You know, we really are. You know, in order to make something that affects other people, you have to be sensitive. And so, you know, unfortunately, it's a double-edged sword and it gets you.
Yeah.
Even if, you know, you can't be sort of, you know, you have to have a bit of a leather hide, but you can't really, you know, carry it all the time.
We're kind of in the same boat and phase of our careers in a strange way. You know, sure. Lol and I have a new album coming out.
Amazing.
It's not something we've done before, so it's a first time. And
Yeah.
So everybody, I suppose, would be expecting, wonder what those two are going to do, because we know what they do.
Yeah.
And we had no idea what we were going to do. We just end up doing what we did. So, there is that expectation, I suppose, and the fans that you've had that you have, and they've probably got expectations of what this new album's going to be like and what you're going to be like.
Yeah.
Have you found you've changed not just the music, but your whole approach? And
yes, definitely. I mean, again, I was very young when it started and I'm in my mid 30s now. I, you know, like, my life just looks totally different than it did when I started. Mm. And I think that the music that I'm making now is reflective of the person that I am. You know, I talk about on this record, like, I talk about the desire of wanting to be a mother and thoughts about, you know, why don't I have a kid yet? And things that I would have never been caught dead talking about in Best Coast, because I was like, Best Coast is where I'm the cool, you know, stoner girl, and I present as this thing.
Right.
And this is me just being a lot more vulnerable because I've become a lot more vulnerable. Right. You know, I'm just, I think it's more authentic to who I am now. Whereas I feel like continuing to move forward with Best Coast started to feel, part of why I decided that I needed to do this was because it started to feel like I was playing a character, and I didn't feel like, I was like, I can't do this anymore. I can't keep playing this character. And maybe someday I'll be ready to go back to playing that character, or I'll go revisit it to celebrate an anniversary or whatever it might be. But for now, I was like, I just want to go be myself. And I was very intentional about making the record in secret. I didn't want the public to know that Best Coast was going to take an indefinite hiatus and Bethany was going to go out and do her own thing.
Right.
Because I knew that the second I let that cat out of the bag, there was going to be anticipation and expectation, and what's it going to be like, and when does it come out? And so I just said, no, I'm just going to, like, I didn't disappear because I was still around, but, you know, artistically, I went into like a full cocoon, and I was like, I'm out of here. You guys aren't getting shit from me until I figure this out. And it made it, that made the process just more kind of like, you know, when you're like a kid and you discover music and you get that feeling of just immense joy and you're like, what is this? And it's this eager excitement of just wanting to know more and learn more. And you find one band and then you connect that band to another band. I just felt that real childlike energy that I haven't felt in a million years. And I know that if this had been something that people knew I was doing, I think I would have been kind of cut off from experiencing that. But also, that's the thing, is I'm smart enough and wise enough now, because I've been in this industry long enough, that I knew I have to do this for myself.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jack Knife Lee.
Assistant editor, Ben Miller. Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cure Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2023.